Stephen King's novel The Shining was about a haunted hotel and a boy named Danny Torrance with psychic powers. In 2013, King wrote a sequel.
In that book, Dan Torrance is all grown up, but still haunted, literally and figuratively, by the ghosts of his past. He's played by Ewan McGregor in the new film Doctor Sleep, which adapts King's sequel. But stay with us here, the movie is also a sequel to the 1980 Stanley Kubrick film The Shining, which is weird because King himself was never a fan of that movie. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Glenn Weldon, and today on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, we're talking about Doctor Sleep. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Mallory Yu. She's the movie editor for All Things Considered here at NPR. Hey, Mallory.
Hey, Glenn.
Okay, let's set the scene. As we mentioned, Dan Torrance is now all grown up and suffering after effects of what we can safely label, I think, childhood trauma. And he has sunk into alcoholism like his father before him. As we watch him start to take steps to fix his life, we meet young Abra, played by Kylie Curran, who also shines. Meanwhile, we are also introduced to the True Knot, that's K-N-O-T, a creepy cult of vampiric beings led by Rebecca Ferguson as Rose the Hat, and we will discuss the Hat, who feed on kids who shine. Now, it's directed by Mike Flanagan, which I just love that because it's such a great meat and potatoes name, Mike Flanagan. I think we all went to high school with a Mike Flanagan, like Mike Flanagan made varsity. Mike Flanagan spewed chunks in homeroom. And he made his bones on some very well-received but low-budget horror. More recently, he's directed an episode of The Haunting of Hill House. And pursuant to this particular discussion, he also directed the movie Gerald's Game for Netflix, which, of course, is based on a Stephen King novel. He said in interviews that this film lives in the same, we can't get away from this term, cinematic universe as the Kubrick film. So, Stephen, what'd you think?
Wow, you just said a mouthful, and there's still more to say in terms of how this movie fits in with the various properties involved. It functions as a sequel to the movie The Shining, mostly from a visual standpoint. Stephen King famously hated the Stanley Kubrick's 1980 film for, I think, actually valid reasons. I think The Shining, the film, is gorgeous to look at. Almost every frame feels iconic, but the characterization, particularly that Jack Nicholson character, King's complaint is that that character doesn't really get any kind of emotional beats. He starts out as a jerk and he turns into a psycho.
Yeah, he starts out as Jack Nicholson and becomes more Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, he's a deeply unlikable, condescending jerk to his family, and then he goes crazy. And I understand what King was saying. I don't hate The Shining, but I know it also makes some choices. It deviates from the plot of the book in some key ways. Now, King, in writing Doctor Sleep, is kind of subtweeting the Stanley Kubrick movie and following exactly in the footsteps of the book and ignoring everything that happens at the end of The Shining. So this movie has to find a way to graft those two parts together. And I think the idea of like grafting multiple parts together is kind of where this movie doesn't quite work for me. It's grafting a lot of parts together that don't always cohere, because now you have the backstory of everything that happened in The Shining and the terrors that were visited upon this family. And now you've introduced this kind of vampire cult that gets a lot of screen time. You have a grisly child murder that I did not enjoy.
So much child death.
And also all this Ewan McGregor backstory, all the Ewan McGregor, what's going on in his life. Ewan McGregor works in a hospice and there's all this stuff in the hospice. This is 2.5 hours of really overstuffed movie that at times I found really effective. So it's a very mixed bag for me.
We're going to come back to that term effective because that's exactly where I came down as well. Mallory, what'd you think?
I agree with a lot of what Stephen said. I found the pacing to be really uneven. There were parts where I was like, this is just too much exposition that I didn't need. You're introduced to characters in the beginning that never really go anywhere and don't get any characterization after, and they just sort of disappear. And for being a movie that was so overstuffed, like Stephen was saying, I felt like the characterization of Danny, of his best friend Billy, were just really weak, which is interesting because that's Stephen King's like main complaint about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. In this movie, I felt like I just didn't know enough about Billy to care about him as Danny's best friend. I didn't know enough about Rose the Hat and her backstory, and I wanted to know more about her. Mm-hmm. For me, Rebecca Ferguson was the most menacing part of this movie. You know, she just oozes this sort of beautiful menace every time mm-hmm. she's on screen. I just wanted more about them and less about the lore. And I don't know if I needed so much about how The Shining works and how many kids are out there. I just don't know if I needed all of that backstory.
Mm-hmm. See, I agree with both of you, and yet I liked it more than either of y'all. And I'll tell you why. I feel like, listener out there, if you liked Kubrick's The Shining and you want to know if this movie is worth your time, ask yourself why you liked Stanley Kubrick's mm-hmm. The Shining. If you liked it because the plot, because of what happens in it, then go see this movie because there is more of that plot and there is more lore, as you mentioned, Mallory. It does pivot away from horror, I think, in a really basic way, because The Shining, Kubrick's The Shining, was all about using horror as a metaphor for the breakup and the dissolution of this family, which is beset by alcohol and abuse and isolation.
And writer's block.
And writer's block. This movie spends most of its running time as an X-Men movie, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be mad at that. Look at me. Who am I? I'm not going to be mad at that. We get a lot more lore, a lot more mythology about The Shining. We get this notion of steam. We get these thermoses of evil that collects the steam, which is very comic booky. Mm-hmm. We get mm-hmm. villains with these really sweaty supervillain code names like Snakebite Andy and Rose the Hat, as you mentioned, and Crow Daddy and Grandpa Flick. And I grew up on comics with Booster Gold and Blue Beetle. Who am I going to complain? Right. The villains are cartoonishly evil, which is a King trait, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to be mad at that either because King works in archetypes, right? I mean, like, when he's creating characters to put a hat on a hat. And speaking of hats, okay, so
you've just been teeing this up.
So Rose the Hat wears a top hat
yes.
Throughout the movie. It's one thing on the page to introduce your character and describe her and say, yeah, she's got a top hat. It is another thing for every single scene for her to be wearing that top hat. So every scene she's in becomes kind of about the top hat. So ultimately, this film builds to something. It's not a spoiler to say there'll be a conflict between Ewan McGregor and Rebecca Ferguson. It's going to answer the question on everybody's mind, which is, can Obi-Wan Kenobi beat Amy Sherman Palladino? Because that's all I thought about. Every scene, like, she's doing this whole boho chic thing. It's like, well, go on. But as ridiculous as the villains were, they were effectively established. Mm-hmm. Yes, they have this ridiculous, over-the-top, child-murdering shtick. You understand that your buttons are being pushed,
right.
But they are being pushed with alacrity and verve. And I can't begrudge it. There's some pacing wobbliness. At 2.5 hours, I found this movie remarkably efficient in a way that I do not associate with King. King kind of faffs around a
right.
lot. And mm-hmm. certainly nobody comes away from the 1980 Stanley Kubrick film The Shining and thinks, yeah, that was efficient. That was a nice narrative thing.
Bounce a quarter off that.
It's not the way it works.
Tight.
Because Kubrick is not interested in tying any knots. Mm-hmm. He is not remotely interested in telling you a story that's going to spring like a steel trap. He's loading you up with imagery. So it's not something he's even vaguely interested in. So if you watch The Shining and you came away from it as a purely cinematic experience, and what you loved about it was the imagery and the auteur-iness of it all, mm-hmm. camera movement and the bright lighting and the score and the pacing and the silence, you know, if that's what you're looking for, you get about 25 minutes of that in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But understand that it is Flanagan just biting Kubrick's style,
yeah,
in a big way.
And it's funny. You hit on several points I wanted to make. I actually have the words superhero origin story in my notes. It is definitely that. I did long for a little bit more of this film's own visual style.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like so many, like, it was really interesting. I rewatched The Shining right before seeing Dr. Sleep because I wanted to have my memory fully refreshed, in part so I would notice all the callbacks. And it was interesting, like, almost every frame of The Shining has become iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And King can differ with the characterizations, like I said, rightfully so, all he wants. But you cannot quibble with how gorgeous that movie is to look at and how memorable each frame is, how endlessly referenced they are. Even if you haven't seen The Shining, you've seen The Shining,
right,
because you've seen a Simpsons Halloween episode or Ready Player One.
Ready Player One, for example.
Or any number of works that echo that film. I think this film effectively beats that drum, effectively draws on the iconography of The Shining, but I wanted a little bit more of its own feel, because clearly this is set up to be, I mean, it is a superhero origin story. There are more stories to tell in this universe, instead of kind of visually rehashing this older film.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I felt like the moments where it was calling back to Kubrick's The Shining were visually some of the most interesting parts of this movie, but I think it's because it's biting off of Kubrick's The Shining, which we all know and love. But aside from those few minutes of that, what shots were there that stick out in my head?
The hat.
What were the shots
the
that
hat,
I...
The hat.
I mean, okay, the hat, but that's a hat. It's part of her costume, and I personally loved the hat. I think as a kid, I would have been obsessed with her look. Like, that was the look that I wanted as a kid, as a 13-year-old or whatever. I just didn't think that there was anything that visually interesting about the movie as a whole until we started seeing the Overlook Hotel. And at that point, I thought that Flanagan did a really good job of melding the two in those few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, again, I come back to the word efficiency here and effectiveness, because seeing the Overlook Hotel again and its environs and seeing shots replicated in the way that we do is fun. It would land on an audience fundamentally differently if, as you mentioned, Stephen, Ready Player One didn't come out last year and do exactly the same thing, only with more CGI bells and whistles. I do think... And I don't want to use the term workmanlike for Flanagan here, but, I mean, he's not an auteur. He's not interested in being an auteur. He's not interested in creating this mood of ambiguity and mystery. These two films are ostensibly sequels. One's a sequel to the other. They're playing in completely different emotional sandboxes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to answer questions. He wants to fill you in with the lore. He wants to throw those thermoses at you. He wants to kind of put everything in a nice little box to lead you to a satisfying ending, which you can see coming a mile away through the midday snow. But that's fine. That's what it's about. This is not... He can't be Kubrick.
Right.
He's not interested in being
right.
Kubrick.
Right.
He's...
King doesn't want him to be Kubrick.
No, no. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And he isn't. So win-win for everybody, right? What about any of the performances? What did you think of Ewan McGregor, for example?
I think Ewan McGregor is fine. He's a really charismatic leading man. And I think whoever his agent is has finally realized how... Ewan McGregor is so charismatic and handsome for the audience. He's styled really well. It's fun to watch him, but I don't know if I found him particularly compelling outside of Ewan McGregor doing Ewan McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved Rebecca Ferguson
as
the Hat. Even Abra. Usually I find child actors to be a little, shall we say, stiff and unnatural. And Abra, for me, was so good. She was compelling and interesting, and there's a bit of darkness in her that you start seeing, some strength and steel that I don't think that Danny in The Shining or in this movie don't have.
Right.
Yeah, I think Kylie Curran as Abra, that is a very effective performance. I'm sure I will wind up watching a movie about her as she continues to find her powers. I agree with everything you said about Rebecca Ferguson and about Ewan McGregor. I think Ewan McGregor, they did a very nice job, I thought, with his makeup to establish how beaten down he is early in this film. I do think that when you are recreating The Shining, this movie is a perfect example of the uncanny valley that exists between recreating a set and recasting these faces.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You have, gotta be careful here.
You have some recreations, some flashbacks, some imagery that involves members of the 1980 cast, in which you are essentially, the way they deal with it is to cast kind of lookalikes, but that absolutely pulls you out. And so it's interesting that with all the digital effects we have at our disposal, you still just have to kind of cast somebody who looks like them.
Yeah.
I agree with Steven. I think that there was a lot of Uncanny Valley, it kept pulling me out, and I kept thinking, how much does this actor really look like the person they're trying to be?
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us what you think about Dr. Sleep, and The Shining, for that matter. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so come right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Third Love. Raelle Cohen, Chief Creative Officer, reflects on the industry trends that Third Love set out to change.
When it comes to bras, they're given a choice between being comfortable or being sexy. And the name Third Love came from this idea that women deserve to have a third option, one that's going to work for them, one that's going to embrace their uniqueness and size and shape, whether they want to be comfortable or sexy.
To find your perfect fit and get 15% off your first order, go to thirdlove.com/PCHH. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card, you can earn 5% back at Walmart online, 2% at Walmart in-store, restaurants and travel, and 1% everywhere else. When you want all that, you need the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. What's in your wallet? Terms and exclusions apply. Capital One N.A.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I think most people listening are fans of the musical Hamilton.
Sure.
Who's not, right?
Safe bet.
It's a pretty safe bet. There is a sort of Hamilton reunion going on in your digital streaming service in the form of three new albums by individual members of the Hamilton cast. Anthony Ramos, who played Philip Hamilton and John Lawrence in Hamilton. He has a new album called The Good and the Bad. It's his debut. It's full of sleek and polished, very approachable pop and soul. Leslie Odom Jr., at the day this episode drops, has a new album called Mister. He plays, of course, Aaron Burr in Hamilton, won a Tony for it. It is a very wild genre mix, even within a given song. And finally, David Diggs won a Tony for his performance as Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette. He has long been a member of a group called Clipping. Clipping is a kind of experimental industrial noise rap group. Their songs are full of very violent imagery. It should be noted that Mallory has been pumping her fist.
Yes.
I
love Clipping, and I love their new album.
Yeah, the new album is called There Existed an Addiction to Blood. And if you want to know kind of what that sounds like, let's hear a little bit of it.
Disappeared in the blink of an eyeball. Bounce man, oh he dead. Lost and found man, oh he dead. Used to be this girl around the way, oh she dead. Looked up to God and you pray, oh he dead, oh she dead. What they say, you got loose, do not stop, do not dwell on the past, use a fool, you got legs, best to use some, don't let them get close.
So that is Clipping, a new album called There Existed an Addiction to Blood, featuring David Diggs from Hamilton. Also new albums by Leslie Odom Jr. and Anthony Ramos.
Three great picks. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Mallory, you, what is making you happy this
week? So there are two things that are making me happy this week. The first one is the song by Demi Adejuyibe.
Yes.
Electro Lemon on Twitter, set to the theme of Succession. So I'm super behind as usual, and I only just started the show, but I've been obsessed with this song for the last month since he dropped it on Twitter. As I've been watching the show, I keep humming it to myself, and as the song says, all the rich white people are going to argue, which adds, I think, a really fun comedic aspect to this show about horrible rich people arguing with each other. Let's hear a little bit of that.
All the rich white folk are going to argue, and then whoever's best is going to win that kiss from daddy. All the rich white folk are going to argue, and then whoever's best is going to win that kiss from daddy.
Because that's the whole show.
Yeah, that's the whole
show. Who's going to win a kiss from daddy? The second one is an essay by Jenny Jung in Eater. It's called The Rise and Stall of the Boba Generation, which boba, if you don't know, is bubble tea. As a Taiwanese American who grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, where boba shops outnumber Starbucks like 3-1.
As well they should.
Exactly. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about this essay or get boba once we're done here. This essay delves into the complexities of Asian American culture and the Asian diaspora. It talks about how bubble tea became an identity among Asian Americans and how that comes with complications of its own. It's just a fantastic deep dive into the commodification of culture and identity. And as an Asian American, I related deeply, and it made me homesick for the San Gabriel Valley. It's called The Rise and Stall of the Boba Generation, and it's written by Jenny Zhang on Eater.
Sweet. Great picks. My pick, what is making me happy this week, I'm going to tip my hat, as it were, about one of the books I selected for the NPR Book Concierge this year. It is a graphic novel called Death, Winds, a Goldfish, Reflections from a Grim Reaper's Year-Long Sabbatical by Brian Ray. It is a fast, funny, stylish read, so here it is. Basically, Death, Black Hood, Robe, Scythe, the whole schmear, gets informed by HR that he hasn't taken a vacation day ever. So they force him to go on a year-long vacation, and he proceeds to try to fill up a year figuring out what to do when he's not killing folks. So he goes to a carnival and wins the titular goldfish, and he keeps a diary. As he hits the slopes, he goes scuba diving. He grabs a coffee, and this is my favorite joke in the book. When he grabs the coffee, we just see his coffee cup, and we see that the barista has written the name Beth onto the cup. Solid piece of business. And it is drawn in this deceptively childlike way with pencils. He's a scratchy stick figury Death in a scratchy but very evocatively drawn world. And by the end of it, life lessons are learned, or death lessons, I suppose. So that is Death Wins a Goldfish by Brian Ray. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find us all on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Mallory at Mallory_YU. You can follow our producer, Emmanuel Johnson, at Emmanuel_Speaks. You can follow our other producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you may or may not be bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you all for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter, and we will see you all next week.
Can we affect the rise and fall of the economy?
Although things may look good for now, many Wall Street analysts are concerned about the warning signs ahead.
Just by the way we talk about it,
the bond markets once again flashing that ominous recession.
How stories and psychology affect our economic fate. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.